But let's open up to Genesis chapter 10 and at verse 25. Two sons were born to Eber. One was named Peleg because in his time the earth was divided. His brother was named Joktan. We've developed a new calculation I wanted to share with you, and it comes out of some questions that we've had thrown our way as I've been on university campuses. And this is the frustration that some express that, you know, this Vela supernova eruption really does seem to be a good tie-in to the shortening of human lifespans from over 900 years down to a maximum of 120. And if you look in Genesis chapter 11, you actually see this exponential drop in lifespan. You go from Noah at 950 to Shem, who lived to be 600. Then Arphaxad, Shelah, Eber, who are all in the neighborhood of 400 years. Then you see it dropping down to the neighborhood of 200, where you got Peleg and Reu and Sereg. And by the time you get to the father of Abraham, it's 119 years. And this is also fits in well with the Vela supernova being one of God's instruments for shortening human lifespan, because it is a radiation event and an exponential decline in human lifespans, as we see portrayed here, would be a good match. But the frustration I've heard from audiences is that our date on the Vela supernova is so very crude. You know, what you'll see in the my book, The Genesis Question, is you got a German group and you got a British group who independently dated the eruption of the Vela supernova, but it comes in at roughly 20 to 30,000 years ago. And a question I get at a lot of university events is, when are you astronomers going to be able to get it down to a precision of, say, plus or minus 1,000 years? Well, it could be a while before we get it down to plus or minus 1,000 years. These measurements from the Vela supernova are not easy to make. And I've noticed in the last 3 years, no one's come out with any new measurements. So we may be stuck with this 20 to 30,000 years for a while. Yes. Well, the Iceman they found in the Alps came in at just over 4,000 years, so it's not that far back in time. And but I do want to report on a study that was made on human beings that were living 20 to 30,000 years ago. That's kind of the scientific discovery I want to use as a bridge to this stuff on Peleg. But the answer is no. We cannot use biochemical analysis of someone that's been dead for 20,000 years and figure out how long they lived. At this point, there is no scientific tool for doing that. Well, what they can tell from the skeleton is how much aging has been taking place in that human specimen. But they cannot tell you the rate of the aging. In other words, they can pick up the bones and say, we have a juvenile or a child or a young adult, or they could, by the osteoporosis that they can observe, just say, you know, perhaps towards the end of that person's lifespan. But it doesn't really give you the rate at which they were aging. You simply know the status of the bones at the point where the bones were deposited. And for that matter, you don't even know the cause of death. You have no assurance that it was natural death. So that is a difficulty. But what I'm going to suggest is that we do have a way to approximately figure out a date for the Vela supernova eruption independent of the British and German studies, and that's through looking at what the text says about in the days of Peleg. You're worried that's going to drop. I understand. Thank you. So, well, one of the questions I want to ask you first off the bat, when we look at this genealogy, and it's kind of repeated twice, you have it in Genesis 10, where it talks about the Semites. You have it again in Genesis 11, verses 10 down to 22, where it gives you the line from Noah down to Abraham. But here's a question for you. Between Noah and Abraham, how many generations are mentioned in the text? Now, obviously, this isn't the total list of generations, but I'm just asking you, how many are mentioned here in the text? How many generations? 10, right. And you know, that's something that's important to note in studying genealogies. Almost all genealogies give you number patterns. And so we have here in Genesis 10 through 11 is a pattern of 10 and 10. 10 generations between Adam and Noah, and 10 generations between Noah and Abraham. Now, does anybody know where in the Bible you could go where you could say, we know the 10 are simply a partial listing rather than a complete listing? Yeah, Luke. You go to Luke 3, and you'll see that there's an extra name in the Luke genealogy for the line between Noah and Abraham than there is here in Genesis 10 and 11. So a name has been dropped out, provably, from the text here. Now, there could be a bunch of other names dropped out. And interestingly, when you go to Matthew's genealogy, you see it's laid out as 14, 14, and 14. And when you compare the Matthew genealogy with the one in 1 Chronicles, chapter 1 through 9, you notice that the Matthew genealogy drops a whole bunch of names when you start to go down the line of kings from King David down to the Exodus. Lots of names dropped off. But the whole idea is that the chronologer is saying, these are the 14 names that I consider to be the most significant dimension between David and the Exodus, or David and Abraham, or Abraham back to Adam. Whereas here you got 20 generations mentioned from Adam through to Abraham. And we know those 20 are not complete, but the whole point is the chronologer was wanting to establish this pattern of 10 and 10, or in the case of Matthew, 14, 14, and 14. Not to interpret that as complete. On the other hand, the fact that we see this 10 and 10 allows us to make some crude estimates for the date of the flood. So what this tells us is that the Peleg was halfway down the line between Noah and Abraham. Halfway. Now, there was a hand I saw at the back, so it was a quick question, yes. Yes, it can be a poetic license. It could be simply the chronologer saying, you know, I like the number 10, or I like the number 14. 14 is 7 times 2. I'm going to pick what I think are the 14 heroes, or the 14 principles. And, hey, people do that in their own genealogies today. I mean, if you've got some guy who is a horse thief in your line, you may decide just to drop that gentleman off your genealogy. But as you go through the Bible, it's interesting. Sometimes it picks the heroes, other times it picks the villains. For example, in Chronicles, there's special attention to pick out the Gentiles that show up in the list, making the point that the God of Israel is not just a God to those that are born of the biological seed of Abraham, but also the God that's part of the spiritual seed of Abraham. So it makes a point of mentioning Gentiles. Other times there's a legal requirement being established. If you remember in Samuel where it talks about the genealogy of King David, and there is a legal precedent being set because in the Levitical law it makes the point that a man could not serve as ruler over the kingdom unless 10 generations or more proceeded from an illegitimate birth in that person's genealogy. Well, if you look at David's genealogy, there was an individual who had an illegitimate birth. So if you go far enough back in David's line, there is one born out of wedlock that's part of that line. And so what we see in Samuel is a list of enough names to say, hey, legally, David had the right to take the throne. Although legally, his father, Jesse, did not have the right. And so in that part in Erdi and Samuel, where the peoples gather around Samuel and say, give us a king. And Samuel said, the time is not right. And they said, well, we want a king anyway. And therefore, Samuel had to go outside of the tribe of Judah to pick a king because it wasn't legal for this descendant of, I forget what was the, which son of Judah that had the illegitimate birth. His wife's name was Tamar. Maybe you can help me with the details. He gave rise to a son. I'm trying to think of which son of Judah that was. But anyway, it just slips my mind right off the moment. You'll find it mentioned here in Genesis. There's a story in Genesis chapter 38 that describes this account. And so so it wasn't legal for this particular line to take the throne. It was okay for to go to Benjamin. So that's why Saul got picked and not Jesse. Jesse was not legal, Saul was, and so the genealogy is mentioned to make that legal point. So maybe those 10 generations have a factor here in the Genesis count. That's been speculated by some Bible scholars that a legal point is being made here in Genesis 10 and 11 as well. Anyway, that's off the subject. If we have Peleg halfway down the genealogy, the interesting thing here is in the days of Peleg, because in his time the earth was divided. I mean, as I look at all the dates for the history of humanity between Abraham and Noah, the one that is best established by the scientific record is the dividing of the world in the days of Peleg. And you'll see some description of this in our book, The Genesis Question. And we believe that this description of the earth was divided in the days of Peleg is a reference to the breaking of the Bering land bridge, or the breaking of the bridge that separated France from England, or the bridge that separated Asia from Australia and New Guinea. But the one that would be most definitive, I think, would be the separation of the Western Hemisphere from the Eastern Hemisphere, which would be the Bering land bridge. And the date when that bridge became passable for human migration was 14,000 years ago. It was actually intact 30,000 years ago, maybe even 35,000 years ago. But in terms of being passable for human migration, not until 14,000 years ago. I mean, if the temperature in the Bering land bridge is 40 below zero 12 months of the year or colder with high winds blowing and no food, this is not a very passable route for Stone Age peoples. On the other hand, if it's 55 degrees and there's wheat and rye growing all the way and oats, then it does become a passable bridge. And that was the situation. 14,000 years ago, the temperature of the Bering land bridge rose above freezing and got as high as 55 degrees. 56 degrees was the maximum annual average temperature, which made human migration possible. But 11,000 years ago, the sea levels rose. The sea floor between Alaska and Siberia dropped with the melting of the ice in both Alaska and Siberia. And that caused the land between Siberia and Alaska to literally drop a little more than 500 feet. And now you've got the Bering Strait. And that strait is so wide, so cold, and so windy that literally not until about 120 years ago was it safe to pass that strait in a boat. And so what you have are the Eskimos and the Indians literally cut off from the rest of humanity for 10,000 years. 11,000 years they were cut off. People couldn't go back, and people couldn't come. So, in that, my opinion, that's a good interpretation of the phrase here in Genesis 10:25. In his time, the earth was divided. North and South America became permanently divided, at least in terms of human time scales, with respect to Asia, Europe, and Africa. Because now you've got a treacherous strait that can't be crossed without modern navigation. Yes. Nobody could have known that. You're right. So, and by the way, this isn't the only piece of evidence. All over North America, there's evidence that there was this massive rising of sea levels, 10,500 to 11,500 years ago. Probably the most definitive studies have been done off the Queen Charlotte Islands. And the Indians in the Queen Charlotte Islands were cut off for 10,500 years from the other Indians in North America because their bridge had been broken and it was too treacherous to cross. And interestingly, it shows up in their legends. Their legends actually have this story of this rapidly rising sea level, where the sea level was actually going up 30, 40 feet every century. And how they were thinking about going back to the mainland and discovered they couldn't mount an expedition fast enough because the ocean was rising so fast. That's actually in the Haida Indian legends. And so many archaeologists believe that that actually qualifies as the oldest recorded history of humanity. because it actually takes you back to 10,500 years ago. And it was, the legend had so much detail in it. Now it's being accurately confirmed by carbon-14 analysis. But the whole point here is that of all the dates we can establish, this one's the most accurate. It's all carbon-14 dated, both the opening of the bridge 14,000 years ago and the closing of the bridge 11,000 years ago, with a precision that's better than 5%. So that's the one couple of accurate dates we have for this account here in Genesis 1 through 11. And what I'm going to suggest is maybe we can use that to firm up a little bit which side of the error bar you want to go to for the Vela supernova. So here's the exercise. What you do is you take all the people mentioned in the Genesis 11 genealogy, and you look at the lifespans of the patriarchs before Peleg and the patriarchs after Peleg. Now, here's what you get. I'll give you the numbers. I won't force you to do the additions and the averages. You'll get 444.33 years for the patriarchs living before the days of Peleg, and after the days of Peleg down to Abraham's father, you get 184 years. So 444 and 184 years. And what that tells you is that if this is representative of the lifespans before the days of Peleg and after the days of Peleg, and that's a 30 big if, then we're looking at about 71% of the passage of time between Noah and Abraham as being between Noah and Peleg, and 29% from Peleg down to Abraham. Okay? Now, we do have a firm historical date for Abraham. Anybody know what that is? 2000 BC is an agreed date by all Bible scholars for when Abraham lived. Plus or minus 100 years. Some say plus or minus 50, but, you know, to be safe, plus or minus 100. That's 4,000 years ago. So there you got a date, 4,000 years ago, relatively accurate. And then we have 29% of the time going up to the days of Peleg, and 71% from Peleg all the way to Noah's flood. Okay, well, we got Peleg's date roughly measured at about 11,000 years ago. So you got 11,000 years ago and 4,000 years ago, okay, and then you can do the math. Now, here's how you can work it out. We have this error bar of 20,000 years ago for the Vela supernova eruption, or 30,000 years ago. Very roughly, those are the limits put out by the German and British studies. Okay, you take 20,000, you subtract 4,000, what do you get? 16,000. Multiply 16,000 by 0.71, what do you get? Anybody got that off in your head right off the bat? 11,000, yeah, you're right, about 11,400, 11,300 years ago. You subtract those 11,360 years from 20,000 years, and you get 8,640 years ago, the world was divided in the days of Peleg. Well, that's a little too recent. Okay, let's try the other end and see what you get. Try the other end, 30,000 years. Subtract 4,000. What do you get? 26,000. Multiply it by 0.71. What do you get? 18,000. Boy, you guys are good. 18,460. You subtract 18,460 from 30,000. What do you get? 11,543 years ago. So what does that tell you? The 30,000 edge of the error bar, if the days of Peleg are properly analyzed in terms of the genealogy, would seem to fit, whereas the 20,000-year limit seems to be too recent. So what you've got is a 30,000-year date just slightly more distant in the past than this 11,000 years, and then the 20,000-year limit gives you a date that's way too recent. So that would seem to favor the Vela supernova eruption taking place closer to the 30,000 years than the 20,000 years, probably a lot closer. Of course, this all depends on the fact that we're saying that our analysis here has some confidence, and that is disputable. mean, all you got here are four names between Noah and Peleg, and four names between Peleg and Abraham, and who's to say those dates we have there are representative? They may not be. It's also assuming that we're having here is the translation that this guy who's mentioned, Arphaxad, for example, begins a line that ends 430 years later. That may not necessarily follow. It could be the end of the line, the beginning of the line, or somewhere in the middle. So I do want to caution you, this is fraught with a lot of uncertainties, both in interpretation as well as the mathematics. But I think what makes this somewhat more supportive is what's the earliest date we have for the eruption of advanced art expression by human beings. They call it the Big Bang of art. And it all comes out of Spain and France, because that's where they found these caves, all kinds of caves, lots of limestone there, so you've got lots of caves. And this is where they find the equivalent of the Sistine Chapel, these guys just painting an entire wall of a cave, dense with these paintings of creatures and hunters and the weapons they use to hunt these creatures. And the quality of art is really equivalent to the art that we express today. So it shows us the beginning of human art expression. And the earliest date we have on that is 33,000 years ago. Is that a carbon-14 date? No, it's not. If it was a carbon-14 date, it wouldn't be very accurate anyway, because carbon-14's half-life is just 5,700 years. So it's not a very accurate date. But on the other hand, they have like seven or eight caves that they have been able to date with luminescence methods, and they fall between 11,000 years ago and these 33,000 years ago. So whatever credence you want to put in that 33,000-year date, it is more consistent with a 30,000-year date for the Vela supernova than it would be the 20,000-year date. So here's an example where you can just take some math out of the Bible and test an apologetic hypothesis. And it would seem to favor an earlier date for the flood rather than a later date for the flood. Now, if you wait long enough, the astronomers eventually will come through and give us a more accurate date for the Vela supernova. But if you don't want to wait, hey, we can just look what we got here in Genesis and kind of rough it out. So, but the fact that you're getting a consistent picture, I mean, the earliest evidence we have for human religious expression is about 20 to 24,000 years ago. And so you'd have to have the Noahic flood before that date. And then the Big Bang of art, of course, would also have to take place a little bit before the Noahic flood. Now, one of the things that came out in my message at Dartmouth College a couple of weeks ago was, have you ever thought of using the Vela supernova as an argument for why humanity was not global at that time, or why the flood would be local in its extent rather than global in its extent? And there was an astronomy student there who simply made the point. The Vela supernova is such an incredibly dramatic event that if it were witnessed by human beings, there's no way we wouldn't have the story come down to this very day. And just to put this in context, we're talking an object that when it was erupting, and we're talking a seven-month span of time, it would have been brighter than the full moon. So it would have been considerably brighter than the full moon, obviously visible in daytime as well as nighttime. Imagine seeing this thing at night, brighter than a full moon. It also brought about the extinction of many species that were exposed to its ultraviolet radiation. There really, as this student argued, no way that this would have failed to have found its way into the culture, the legends, and the writings of ancient peoples if they had actually seen this thing. Now the whole point here is it took place in the constellation Vela. Well, you have to live rather far south before you can see the constellation Vela. And for example, if you look at Mesopotamia, even when you're down at the southernmost end of the valley of Mesopotamia, the Vela supernova would not have been visible to you. It would have been below the horizon and it would not have been seen. You have to drop about another 10 degrees south before the Vela supernova becomes visible. So given, I mean, if there were people in Australia or South America or South Africa, yeah, they would have seen this spectacular eruption. And incidentally, I understand that's also shown up in secular literature, this question. Why do we not have any story of the Bella supernova in our human culture? Could it be that nobody was around to see it? So even secular scholars have made note of the fact that, and see, this really challenges a lot of the thinking that's coming out. Remember this new idea of mitochondrial DNA analysis? We're saying that proves we all came out of southern Africa. That's where Adam and Eve lived, was in southern Africa. While if the human species really did come out of southern Africa, then why not the story of the Vela supernova? And of course, let me just ask you a question. Because we get this a lot on our Reasons to Believe radio network about this out of Africa thing. What's the fallacy in looking at mitochondrial DNA, seeing all this diversity? I mean, really the argument is this. If we take human beings that are alive today, scattered over planet Earth, the location where we see the greatest genetic diversity in the mitochondrial DNA is southern Africa. Therefore, we came from southern Africa. That's where our ancestors first came from. What's the fallacy? Well, the argument is that where you got the greatest genetic diversity, you got the greatest passage of time. Given that mitochondrial DNA will mutate slowly over time, the longer a group of people have been in a locale, then the greater the diversity they would show up in the genes. That's why they concluded we must come out of Africa. But what's the basic fallacy in that? Okay. Well, I think your comment you made first is probably the most significant. These biologists who are drawing that assumption, anthropologists, are assuming that we human beings behave like non-intelligent animals. Namely, that our evolution is purely random and undirected. If it's random and undirected, they've got a case. But isn't it possible that human beings have such an advanced culture, even if you go back tens of thousands of years ago, whereby we may be doing things that, in terms of migration, that have got nothing to do with the survival of the fittest? The natural evolutionary driving forces may not be the most significant factor in where people wind up. And so if there was a reason, in other words, you could have, say, a human origin in Asia, and a whole bunch of people, as it says here, the Hamites went into Africa. What if the sons of Ham were the ones that had all this genetic diversity, and they all go to Africa out of Asia? They're going to take that genetic diversity with them into Africa. And so if you get this directed migration, that has nothing to do with these random Darwinian processes, then finding great diversity in Africa doesn't prove a thing. The other thing is, all this analysis is based on what we see today. Okay, if they really want to make their case, what you want to do is go back, say, 4,000 years ago and do the mitochondrial DNA test again and say, okay, do we still see the greatest diversity in Africa, or do we see it in other places? So it's hard to tell just by looking at people that are alive today what the genetic diversity was in the past. It's also hard to tell whether or not people were practicing certain cultural means of relating to one another that would generate that genetic diversity. And all you got to do is think back to the missionary days of, say, 150 years ago. Remember when the great missionaries, Livingston and others, went into Africa? What did they find when they went into Africa that was made the news all over the world? They found something in the human cultures in Africa, particularly Central and South Central Africa, they'd never seen anywhere else in the world. Anybody remember what? Does anybody remember reading those annals of Livingston and others? Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, what really surprised Livingston was the fact that as he went into Central Africa, he would find a pygmy tribe living right next to a giant tribe. In other words, there were factors going on in the way that they practiced their tribal putting together their tribes that would maintain genetic diversity, or else that genetic diversity would quickly disappear. I mean, that's really true. Nowhere else in the world did you have these people that were 3.5 feet tall. Everybody's 3.5 feet tall, and yet you move a few miles away, and everybody is 7 to 7.5 feet tall. Pretty incredible thing. In Europe, we had tall people. And that's one thing you notice if you read the annals of Julius Caesar. Evidently, the people living in Switzerland were 7 feet tall in average, whereas his soldiers are only 5 feet tall. But guess what? Once the Roman Empire was established, all that diversity quickly disappeared. And suddenly, the Italians got to be a little taller, and the Swiss got to be a whole lot shorter. So, yeah. Yep, you really do. And it's also true as you go into Central and South Africa, even today, you see that these black tribes tend to live apart from one another rather than mix together, whereas Europeans tend to mix together. So there goes your genetic diversity. Yeah. In other words, the sons of Ham seem to live a little differently than the sons of Shem and the sons of Japheth. And that would explain it. What does it say about the sons of Japheth? They were on the move all the time. And so that's going to affect the genetic diversity in the line of Japheth compared to the line of Ham. And actually, I think the real answer to this is what you see here. Who scattered the peoples upon the face of the earth? Was it Darwinian evolution? No, it says God did it. The Lord scattered them from there over all the earth. And, of course, if God is the one, the author of the scattering, he can put the genetic diversity anywhere he wants. And therefore, it doesn't necessarily prove we all came out of Africa. But I want to tell you one encouraging thing from these mitochondrial DNA studies. That does demonstrate that the entire human species is traceable back to one or just a very few individuals. And so the Darwinian premise would be that we are descended from many individuals scattered all over the planet. The answer is we're descended from one or just a few that comes out of one place. That does come out of the mitochondrial DNA analysis. It also puts the date for the origin of humanity at about 50,000 years ago. This is all encouraging. But mitochondrial DNA analysis is not like Y chromosome analysis. The reason that Y chromosome analysis is superior is you're working with nuclear DNA, where you have just two copies in each cell. Whereas with mitochondrial DNA, you're looking at 500 to 1,000 copies. And therefore, there's much more opportunity for mutation in the mitochondrial DNA than there is in the nuclear DNA. And therefore, and not only that, it's also subject to dispute these days whether or not the mother's mitochondrial DNA gets passed on to the sons and daughters of that woman intact. There could be non-mutational factors that would cause a change in that mitochondrial DNA, a process called heteroplasmy, whereby you get a mixing of the mitochondrial DNA independent mutations. And this is why the dates that we get for the origin of humanity based on mitochondrial DNA are in the neighborhood of 40 to 150,000 years ago. Whereas with Y chromosome analysis, it comes in at 37 to 49,000 years ago. So mitochondrial DNA isn't as clean as what a lot of the researchers claim it is. But the good news is, if you give them lots more of your tax dollars, they can make it a lot cleaner than it is today. So there's a hand over here that I missed. All right? I must have answered. Yes, go ahead. Well, what you have is in China a record that do clearly predate the chronology of Archbishop Usher. And that was a big problem when Catholic missionaries went into China around 1600 because they were promoting this Anglican chronology of the Bible that Adam and Eve lived 4004 B.C. And the Chinese said, well, that can't be true because our records show that we Chinese date back earlier than 4004 B.C. And so that became a barrier to spreading this Roman Catholic faith to the Chinese at that time. And some of those records do show an indication that goes way before 6,000 years ago. but it's in the same category as what you see in the Sumerian and Akkadian records. If you look at the fact, those are the three most ancient genealogies we have outside the Bible. The Sumerians in Mesopotamia have a genealogy of their kings. The Akkadians likewise have a genealogy of their kings. And the Chinese have one for their emperors, although really the first emperor comes in about 2500 B.C. So they really don't have anything earlier than that that would be, quote, leaders. But most historians would argue that all three are exaggerated. For example, if you look at the Sumerian and Akkadian records, they claim that a couple of their kings lived about 10,000 years. Not the 900 you see here in Scripture, but 10,000. And several of them come in at 3 and 4, 7,000 years. But there's a whole bunch that come in at about 1,000 years or a little bit less. And so as historians have looked at that, they said, you know, they're trying to make a political point here because it was found in a document that was politically propagandist in nature. And so they said, given the fact they were trying to make this political point, maybe we ought to do is give credence to the lifespans that are at the lower end and ignore those that are at the upper end. When you do that, you come up with lifespans that are consistent with what you see in the Bible. Now, as far as the Chinese records are concerned, they're not that detailed. But people have interpreted them, as you point out, that people were living in China 20,000 years ago. But it's not as detailed as what you've got in the Sumerian and Akkadian records. Both the Sumerians and Akkadians seem to follow this biblical pattern, where they name a guy, he has a son that is born after so many years, and then there's this period of time. But just like with the Bible, it could be simply a lineage that begins with this man. So this would be the dynasty, the length of the dynasty, rather than the length of an individual. But even then, people argue there's exaggeration going on here. So, but I use those extra biblical genealogies as evidence that people in the days before the flood really did live that long. I mean, why would you find this only in the most ancient historical records, not the more recent ones? It only shows up in these most ancient. And by the way, both the Akkadians and the Sumerians have their first line of kings living 1,000 years plus. Their next line of kings don't live that long. We're talking 100 years or less. So it does show this break between long lifespans and short lifespans. Likewise, the Chinese, same thing. Okay, good question. The Vela supernova is a radiation event, and with radiation, you typically get exponential declines. I mean, that's the one thing I noticed in going here in Genesis 11. You do have this exponential decline. Therefore, it took some time for the lifespans to be dropped from 950 years down to this maximum of about 120. That doesn't answer the whole question because, you know, as Fuzz Ron and I, and we also have Richard Deem over here, we wrote an article you'll see in Facts or Faith. It's not just the physical aspects you have to take into account, the declining radiation, or the radiation that would build up over time. That's really what's going on. You also got biochemical adjustments that must be made, and food supply adjustments. I mean, you've got people going from a vegetarian diet to a meat-eating diet, and it may have taken some time for the effects of this meat to kick in. It might have taken some time for the extra metabolic rates of humanity to kick in, and the biochemical changes that would have taken place. The Bible is silent on what God did to biochemically adjust the human species. So all of these are unknown. But the fact that we have an exponential decline as opposed to an abrupt step function doesn't surprise me. You know, it could go either way. God could do it all at once, or we could just have this exponential decline. One theologian I talked to made the point, and it's actually an anthropological point, that from God's perspective, it would make sense to make this a gradual process rather than an instantaneous process, because it would be difficult for you to be living 900 years and your children only get to live 100. I mean, that's a rather That's a rather big shock to cultural readjustment. Because you might say, well, you know, take your time getting your education taken care of. You're going to live to be 900 anyway. You don't have to rush all this stuff. And I really want to, you know, we have long apprenticeships here. And then people realize, well, gee, we're not going to live that long. We better make this a more concentrated effort. So, yeah. Okay, is there any way to test that? Could we go back and find some turtles or alligators and make some measurements on them? I don't know of any such measurements that have been made. I think one of the difficulties is that whereas the human species seems to be designed for maximum lifespan, or more accurately, for maximum heartbeats, the other species of life that are on this planet are not. And, you know, people who have looked at the longevity of other mammals and birds relative to human beings have made the point that in looking at other birds and mammals, there's about a factor of four difference. They have four times fewer heartbeats in their lifespan than we human beings do. So whereas turtles outlive us, they don't get to do that much in their life because their heartbeat just doesn't go that fast. And other animals that have heartbeats equivalent to us, you know, they live, you know, 10, 15 years. I mean, look at our dogs and cats. Their heart beats as fast as ours, but they don't live that long. And so there seems to be some optimal design that's been put into the human species that's lacking the other species. Therefore, trying to use animals to get a fix on the Vela supernova effects may be disappointing. It would only work if everything was at the optimal level. Richard, do you want to add anything to that? Or, since I'm pulling a lot of your material into this, so, yeah, go ahead. Yeah, some Bible scholars have tried to make a point about that, how you do see a slight decline in how many years pass between a man being born and having a son. What makes that difficult, number one, is only about a factor two you can pull out of it. Right. So whales may be at the maximal level. So, and we're out of time. Okay, I was just going to add something. That's an interesting insight about the whales because, you know, given their short extinction time, maybe God balanced it off by having them live longer. And hey, they live in water. That's an advantage too. Okay. Well, I never got to the scientific discovery I wanted to talk about, but I will give you a little hint about it. It has to do with the division between Neanderthal and humanity. Three research papers got published in the last 8 days where they've been able to analyze the bones of Neanderthals that are the most recent and the humans that are the most ancient. And it's still disputed whether they overlapped or not, but it puts you back into that era of the flood about 30,000 years ago. And what they're able to demonstrate is that Neanderthals were eating very different food than the humans were. We'll talk about it next week. Father in heaven, we thank you for the fact that we live in a day and an age when discoveries are coming at such a rapid clip that are giving us greater confidence that this book you gave us thousands of years ago really is your perfect, error-free word message to us. And Lord, I pray you give all of us opportunity this very week to share this news with people that don't know you yet as Lord and Savior. Lord, that they may come to the recognition that you have spoken and that you have spoken faithfully. And this is a message that they really are compelled to read and study and respond to give an answer for the message that you've given to us. So Lord, make us fruitful through these new discoveries. I pray, Father, that our faith would be stronger, we'd be more confident, and that you would equip us with new opportunities to be emissaries of your good news. In Jesus' name, amen.